Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show, The Children's Corner. Today, my very special guest is James R. Hannibal, and he is author of the newly released book for young adults called The Fourth Ruby. It's been a year since Jack Buckles discovered the keep beneath Baker Street, an underground tower no Section 13 was ever supposed to see. A year since his dad fell into a coma, nothing has been the same since. Jack's tracker abilities are on the fritz, Gwen's not speaking to him, and what's worse, there's a pounding voice in his head calling for the flame. This is just a bit of the suspense that is in the new book, The Fourth Ruby. As a former stealth pilot, James R. Hannibal is no stranger to secrets and adventure. He has been shot at, locked up with surface-to-air missiles, chased down a winding German road by an armed terrorist. He is the award-winning author of the Section 13 Mysteries for Kids and the Nick Barron Covert Ops series for adults. James lives with synesthesia, meaning his senses intersect. So if he tells you the chocolate cake you offered smells blue and sticky, take it as a compliment. James' new book is available at Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome James to the show. Good day, sir.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I am doing wonderful. Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure. And I, you know, even though this book is for young adults, it's for adults who like to be young, so you know that's my kind of reading. So first of all, you know, as I mentioned, this is for young adults. So, what age would you kind of classify that particular genre would appeal to?
This particular genre is meant for ages 8 to teen. This particular series, Project Muse at John Hopkins, labeled it ages 8 to 80. So we like that expanded age range.
I'm sure you do. And like I said, you know, I'm right within that range. So and I do enjoy you know, because there's just something simple and clean and just you know, it's just a good old fashioned adventure. So that I really enjoy that. So now, what drew you to writing for this particular audience? It's a very distinct group.
It is. And, you know, I was writing in the covert ops arena because working in the stealth and with those type of three-letter agencies, that was my arena, and that's where I thought I was meant to write books. But while I was working as an airline pilot after my Air Force career, I was over in England, and I was spending a lot of my time flying back and forth to England. And while I was in London, I went out searching for the address of Sherlock Holmes, the famous 221B Baker Street. And the tube, the Jubilee line, I think it is, or the Bakerloo line maybe, brings you in that you know, the underground train to Baker Street, and the walls have murals that are illustrations from the Strand, the original adventures. And so that really puts you in the mystery mood. And as you're coming up the stairs, the tiles have the silhouette of Sherlock Holmes in the deerstalker cap. And then you see these signs, this way to the Lost Property Office. And I could not help but just follow them because I didn't know what that really meant. But they lead you up to Baker Street. In fact, they lead you to 200 Baker Street, just a couple doors down from the Sherlock Holmes Museum, which is what is really at 221B now. And there is the Lost Property Office. And in the window, there's a top hat from the 1930s that's all worn. There are some old yellowed LP covers and an iron. This is the an iron, like it came off the set of Downton Abbey, and you discover that, that these are all things that were left on trains and taxis because this is the lost and found for all of London for the last century. And so this seemed to me this must be, because it's on Baker Street, it has to be a front for a secret society of detectives that has served the British crown for centuries. And that struck me as a children's story. And then I was also separated from my family at the time because the airline that I worked for had displaced me out of my hub to New York, and I was spending most of my time in either New York or London. Judy Bloom's editor, I happened to, at a large publishing function, be seated next to him. In the space of 5 minutes, he listened to me tell the background on The Lost Property Office, which was the first book in this series. The Fourth Ruby is the one that just came out, and why I was there. And he psychoanalyzed me. Oh, well, the reason that this is a story about a boy searching for his father is because you were missing your own sons at the time that you conceived the idea, and I'm crying, and he's standing up going, I think our time is up now. So it was a fun thing.
Wow, that's amazing. That's it's just one of those things that is there's such synchronicity there that when you sit back and look at it, the odds of all of that unfolding and then leading to the series is kind of makes you stand up and take notice.
No, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So now I want to talk a little bit about the Fourth Ruby itself. But before we get there, when it comes to writing for the young audience, are there any particular challenges that you have to consider when writing for that particular group?
In my book, you're wanting to hold an attention span, and I do write to make sure that I write for the entire group. I want to make sure that boys, especially who these days tend to gravitate more towards video games and other things, have their attention held. And so when you're writing for that group, and to be honest, I'm told that James Patterson actually uses this for adults, but I write with a little bit shorter chapters. We have a normal-sized book, but the action happens a little bit faster, and the dialogue is a little tighter, and I'm actually finding that I kind of prefer to do some of my adult writing in the same fashion. Maybe that's what Mr. Patterson discovered, but we're doing that to hold the attention of the reader. I'm not talking down to the kids or simplifying, but I am thinking of them, and also the challenge is to make sure that you connect with them on their level. And one of the things that helped me with that is we work in a very large homeschool co-op in our area of Houston. It's a wonderful organization called HEART, H-E-A-R-T. And my wife and I ran the middle grade boys book club. That's, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade boys book club for 2 years. And that was fantastic research for writing for this age group.
Wow, that would be, that would be great. Keeping in mind that, when you said about keeping their attention, are there any particular themes or areas that are, particularly of interest, to that particular age group?
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with R.L. Stine's work, and I've had the opportunity, thanks to organizations like Thriller Fest and BoucherCon, which is the World Mystery Convention, to listen to Mr. Stine talk about his writing and his techniques. And, he says that, kids love being scared. Now, I don't write horror, but I do think that you begin to hold some rapt attention when you make, when something of just a little bit creepy is happening. And actually, the producers from Sony who've talked to me about this story, because it has been optioned by Columbia Pictures, tell me that they were, that's one of the things that grabbed them, was the suspense at that age level without the gore. And so it wasn't really horror, but it was that a little bit of creepy suspense that gives kids a little bit of goosebumps, which R.L. Stine's aptly named series has that title.
Yeah. Well, and I can see that, you know, that popular Stranger Things on Netflix is a good example of you know, things that are just spooky enough, you know, to grab kids, you know, but you know, you don't want to give them nightmares.
Right. Yeah. Actually, no, I don't let my kids watch Stranger. That's a little bit too far beyond. Just with the that monster that comes out is significant.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, come to think, but you're right. So let's talk a little bit about The Fourth Ruby. Now, again, this is a book in the series, the Section 13 series. So can you talk about Section 13 and a little bit about the plot of The Fourth Ruby?
So the series kicked off with the Lost Property Office, and Jack Buckles, our hero. Because this is a Sherlock Holmes inspired series, we're talking about another hyper-observant detective, and that's been done many times. That, you know, with Encyclopedia Brown and Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and Monk and Psych and all these things that you can name, all these shows and books that you can name off, they all come back to Sherlock Holmes in one way or another. So Jack Buckles is a new take on the hyper-observant detective. And we can talk about this more at some point. But Jack has, we don't ever say it in the book, but Jack has synesthesia, which is something that I have, where his senses intersect. And that's something I've been able to use to catch bad guys in the past. You know, so he sees sound. He hears movement and flashes of light, and that expands his senses. And so he uses that as his hyper-observant skill. And he has to learn to take it from something that sort of crushes him, and it feels like the world's closing in on him, which is how I felt as a child. And Gwen Kincaid, this person from the Secret Society detectives called the Ministry of Trackers, is the one who helps him learn how to apply that. And instead of his being a tracker, as we call it in the books, being something that makes the world feel like it's closing in on him, it's something that he can use to help stop the mad clockmaker, and in the case of the first book, from recreating the Great Fire of London, and in the case of the Fourth Ruby, stop a thief from reuniting three famous jewels from crown jewels all over the world. So this is the observant side. Now, Gwen Kincaid is our other hero, our heroine, and she is the deduction side. So what we did with the series is we split the Sherlock Holmes observation and deduction pair into two, and we gave the observation to Jack, and we gave the deductions to Gwen. And so the two work as a pair, and in every story they're working to solve a historical mystery in order to stop a present-day villain. In the Lost Property Office, it was the clockmaker with his clockwork beetles that are a little bit creepy, and in the Fourth Ruby, it's the thief. And of course, in the Fourth Ruby is fun because now they're on the run. Not only are they chasing the thief of the crown jewels, but they've been blamed for the heist. And so they're on the run through these other secret societies like the Ministry of Dragons and the Ministry of Secrets and the Ministry of Guilds, and they have to face an underground city of thieves in order to chase down the real thief and stop the thief from reuniting these famous rubies that are real rubies that have an 800-year history of blood and betrayal that spans six empires. But they have to follow the clues and stop that thief, because reuniting those gems with a surprise Fourth Ruby, and for spoilers, we can't tell you its shocking origin, but that would unleash an ancient evil that once wiped out 10% of the Earth's population.
Wow, boy. Talk about a mission.
Yes, know? Yeah. We really raised the first one. We were saving London. Now we're saving the world. So Jack's the pressure on Jack is mounting.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, I probably the next thing is the universe, is the galaxy. So I see a little extraterrestrial thing coming in next. Well, you know, that's really great. You know, I mean, that's the type of suspense and action that, you know, really, you know, draws in kids. You know, so now you mentioned the synesthesia aspect. First of all, when did you recognize that this was something that affected you?
You know, and it wasn't me, actually. It was my wife that figured it out. And she does. She gets credit for a lot. the story, without her, the story would never have been written, because I was just determined that the publishing world wanted me to continue writing covert ops and CIA books. And she was the one who convinced me to pitch this idea to my literary agency, and of course they ran with it. There's a calico cat in the stories. In the archive, which is this ancient well of books, a literal well of books that seems bottomless, and there may be a dragon at the bottom, we don't know. It's this mystical place, but there's an archivist who's kind of like the librarian that goes up and down the well of books in a hot air balloon. The archivist's sidekick was originally a spectacled bear, and my wife saved us all from the spectacled bear on the hot air balloon, which we can all imagine would have been a disaster. And instead, there's this calico cat that is the star, one of the stars of the Lost Property Office, and makes new appearances in the Fourth Ruby. But so it was my wife that recognized that I was different. And so, you know, when you're a kid with synesthesia is not well known. Even today, it's not well known. When I go to schools, and I've talked to 6,000 children this year, I'll probably talk to another 3,000 in the next couple of weeks, visiting schools and talking about creative writing. But I always ask how many know what synesthesia is, and very few of them have ever heard of it. And even the parents, it's not well known. And so as a child, I just thought I struggled more to deal with the world than everyone else, and I thought I had to work harder. And, of course, I had a strong Midwestern father who, you know, his answer to any cut was, you know, rub some dirt on it. And his answer
right.
to, you know, me getting sick on every Tuesday because it was onions and peas day, and onions to me is like, the smell of onions for me is like walking through black sludge. I feel it, and there's nothing that I can do about that. That's part of my synesthesia. So I learned to deal with it, and by learning to deal with it, I think it made me an effective military operator later in life. That's how we decided. So now I'm married, and I've never learned what this was. I did learn to deal with it, and I just assumed that everybody saw colors with sound and other things. And as we begin to, it was an argument one day, and I don't remember exactly what the argument was, but it was, you know, how can you not see that it's green? And she's like, what are you talking about? And then we, you know, you're weird. No, you're weird. And so then we went home and we Googled it. We discovered, and we started looking at these different symptoms, the different ways that I see the world. One of the side effects of synesthesia is color graphemia. So all letters and numbers for synesthetes have their own individual color that never changes. It makes us very, very good at rote memorization. We looked up that, and we discovered, oh, you have this thing called synesthesia. Not only that, but you have a very uncommon form where four of your senses intersect rather than two.
Wow, that's amazing. First of all, to have gone that long. Oh, and by the way, I do notice that you give Cindy, your wife, a lot of credit. You know, in the acknowledgement right up front. So,
We are a team.
I could tell it. That kind of came through just in that acknowledgement area. To have gone, you know, through a lot of life, you know, not knowing. I mean, to me, that's a. It's just amazing how adept one can be, you know, particularly children, when it comes to dealing with things that are unusual, you know. And, you know, I didn't for many years know what that was until I started doing the shows, and there were a couple people who also were had that condition or that particular aspect. And it was, you know, to me, it just blew my mind. But it also kind of opened up the my mind to recognizing that there could be benefits to that. So for you, I mean, obviously, onions and black sludge are not a really good kind of correlation. But I mean, are there any? In what ways does that benefit you? I mean, are there, you know, in what ways kind of does it help you, or, you know, contribute to either to your work, particularly with the U.S. Air Force, but also in writing? How does that help?
In a lot of ways, it has helped me, and it's, you know, especially again, just learning to deal by being thrust into it. I assume as a child, by the time that I got into my military career and began to focus on being able to see the differences, and it's like looking at the world through a couple of different screens at the same time. And if you what I do is basically choose which screen to look at, and that's sort of how Jack does. He chooses which sense or which piece of data to look at in the books and find the trail of the villain, and so I do the same thing. My color graphemia, which is the side effect where colors or letters and numbers have colors, really helped me as a forward air controller. Forward air controller in the Air Force, when you're flying in a Warthog A-10 fighter, gets to a target area early and orbits the target area. And as other fighters show up on scene, the Warthog pilot forward air controller is finding targets for them, and then you put the fighters in various areas. Okay, you're going to be up in area A at 5,000 feet. You're going to be in area B at 6,000 feet. And so you've got an F-18 over here with two Mark 84s and an F-16 over here with, you know, six Mavericks. And all of that, you need to keep all of that data straight. You could be on you could be on scene for an hour and a half controlling fighters. And so for someone with color graphemia, that makes things a little bit easier to organize. And then, I tend to see the sounds that are unusual. You get used to the certain sound of engines, and so I can identify very, very quickly when the engines are vibrating oddly. I identified a hydraulic issue in a stealth bomber once with a bomb bay door, and the stealth is extremely loud in that cockpit. You have quite a bit of engine noise being contained in the airframe as part of the stealth, and you can't talk to one another without the intercom. And yet, through that noise is just a different appearance, a different color and texture to the noise. And I could see a hydraulic motor cycling. And so those are the type of things. And there's some other things that I did working in counterterrorism. Unfortunately, I can't talk about those operational details on the radio.
Okay, that's great. But, you know, to me, it's, you know, I can see where, you know, that that would be a benefit. You know, just that difference. And when you indicated that you chose like which screen or which sense, you know, to me it's it seems that you become more aware of the senses. You know, in the sense, because, you know, for most people, you know, we really, and when we hear something, we see something, you know, we really don't distinguish, you know, senses or differentiate senses as a rule. But with that particular aspect, it seems like you are hypersensitive in a way to different sensory modes.
Right, and that's something that where it really plays into the writing. Publishers Weekly's Shelf Talker, which is their children's blog, really seemed to key in on that aspect of the Lost Property Office when it first came out, and that is the dynamic sensory nature of the writing in this series. And for me, that's natural, but we tend as human writers to focus on the visual. And so descriptions in books tend to be visual focused, and you have to remind yourself as a writer to include sounds, and you really have to work hard to include smells and tastes to get and feeling to get a broader sensory experience for the reader. For me, that comes a little bit more naturally, I think, just because I see the world in so many ways, I think. And then especially because we're in this series, we're focused on the hero using that crossed senses, his crossed senses, as his main skill that helps him catch the bad guy, then it really comes out in the series. In fact, the publishers had me tone it down in my test readers. In both cases, there have been things that I've described, which would be the way that I would see something, where they said, this is just not believable. And so we've drawn it back.
Wow.
One thing we do that is fun, though, for me at least, is we embellish the synesthesia for Jack in that when he touches stone or steel or any mineral, he can sense the vibrations in the molecules, and those vibrations translate in his tracker brain into sight and sound. So he can see the history recorded there, and every mineral shows up differently. Stone has a deep, long memory, but it's all shadows and modeled. But brass and steel have a vibrant memory, but it's short. You only can look back maybe a few hours or a few days. And then, of course, jewels are the pinnacle, and they have both the vibrant memory and the long memory, and so you can look back centuries and see what happened. And so that's been a fun part of the series to play with.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, you know, I would think that, you know, because this, you know, there's so little known about it, that having Jack have that characteristic would be such a great way to raise awareness, you know, and for children who are experiencing synesthesia, that would be, God, a welcomed relief for them.
Absolutely, and I really hope that kids read this, and those kids, you know, about one in the numbers range between 1 in 400 and 1 in 2,000 children has some level of synesthesia. And about 1 in 200,000 kids is going to have it all the way to my level. But I would love for kids to read this, and those kids that have experienced color graphemia or chromesthesia, which is the sounds have color, those are the two most common forms, to say, oh, that's me. I recognize this in myself. And I would love for teachers to read this and get a better understanding, because we tend to be quick to, when kids have trouble paying attention, and for me, you know, when the bird is chirping outside the window while I was in fifth grade trying to listen to the teacher, I'm seeing flashes of, you know, I'm seeing these pink spikes and yellow spikes in front of my eyes as the bird is chirping outside the window, and the groundskeeper goes by with the lawnmower, and I'm feeling this rumbling against my neck and seeing brownish gray sort of bubbles in my vision, and I'm wondering why nobody else is having trouble paying attention. So when teachers see a kid that's having trouble paying attention, we immediately jump to ADD or ADHD. And in one case, a reviewer for a respected journal failed to read the back cover and took it upon herself to diagnose Jack Buckles, the fictional character, as on the autistic spectrum. And so I would really like to raise awareness of synesthesia so that kids can correctly identify. And if they understand synesthesia, then they can take advantage of those things that are useful, such as being able to do well with organization of numbers and letters.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, with that understanding, modify teaching style and being able to, you know, make the most, you know, of that. So, that's great. And I can see where that would, the story of Jack, you know, would definitely do that. Now, your experience in the U.S. Air Force, so obviously you've got a lot of experience with bad guys and action and that kind of thing. So does that experience just make it easier for you to throw together, not to throw together, but to weave a tale, you know, of you know, good versus evil?
Well, you know, let me share with you a little secret. I'm not sure if I've mentioned this in public before, but, you know, when I was writing my covert, my Nick Baron series, which is through Penguin, is my covert ops series. And every one of those books I've had to send through security committees, and in one case, multiple security committees, to make sure that I don't say anything that violates my non-disclosures from my previous high-level clearances. And so here we now have a children's story where we have secret societies and a lot of secrets, and also secret societies that tend to be a little over exuberant about their regulations, which I got to play with sort of that British nature with these what they would call ministries. And so these four secret ministries: the Ministry of Trackers, Ministry of Dragons, Ministry of Secrets, and Ministry of Guilds. But with this series, there's nothing in there that relates to my background overtly, in any case. And so I could take that culture of a secretive society, which might be an organization in government or military, and translate it into a more fantasy secret society. And so I got to take that atmosphere and put it into a children's story. And it's a little bit more comfortable because I don't have to run these things through security committees before I can send them to the publisher.
Yeah, I can see where that'd be the case. But wouldn't it be interesting about some of those? You know, sometimes, you know, fiction does kind of mirror reality in some ways. So, and there are secret societies. So who knows? But it is good that, you know, that you don't have to, you know, go for that approval. And putting it more into the fanciful kind of structure, you know, does allow you freedom. So now you mentioned a little bit about you talked to 6,000 students so far and probably another 3,000 by the end of the year. So would you mind sharing with us exactly what it is that you do for schools?
Absolutely. I travel around the country. I've done just in the last couple of weeks. I've done New York. I was out in Sag Harbor with some wonderful children, and then tomorrow I'm actually doing workshops all day at a school in Houston, and then in the following week I will go to Denver, and I think I'll do 9 schools in 5 days. And what we do is the kids and I create a story together. So when I visit a school, we mention the books because my publisher and my publicist would both kill me if we didn't. But then we jump into story creation, and we call it From Inkling to Ink. And what we're doing is showing the kids when their teacher says, "Write me a story," and they say, "Well, what's a story?" And the teacher says, "Well, a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end." Well, you know, my arm has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, I can't turn that in for a grade. So when I was a kid and the teacher told me these things, I was still very, very intimidated. And so what I've done now is sort of develop a system using the work of those that have gone before me that I've learned from, you know, people who wrote the Hero with a Thousand Faces and The Writer's Journey and Story Engineering. And we've identified the common points, the common beats that every story ever written shares. And whether the writer knows it or not, these are the story points that are sort of ingrained in all of us. And so if you understand those story beats, then you can write a more effective story. It makes it easier to translate an idea, a single building block, into a complete story outline. And so the kids and I will start with an element such as character, or, you know, hero or villain, or plot, which is the conflict between the hero and the villain, or setting, you know, a time and a place. We'll start with one of those. And we might just start with the future, and then we'll go, okay, where we use that as a building block. Where do we want to set this in the future? Is it in space? Is it on a planet? Is it on a spaceship? And we go from there, and we gather our building blocks, and then we begin to put them into these fill in the blanks, really, in these story beats. And each one helps us fill in the next. And within 45 minutes or so, the kids and I have brainstormed a complete story outline. And the teachers oftentimes will then turn around and have the kids write the stories on their own. And of course, every kid's story is going to be different, even though you've started from that those same story points. But the whole idea is so that when the teacher says, write me a story, the kids will be excited rather than afraid.
Yeah, that's great because, you know, I knew when I was growing up and, you know, a teacher would give me that assignment, it was, I would be a blank. It would be nothing but a blank. You know, it's like, okay, let's see now. You know, luckily, you know, I was always a sci-fi kind of, you know, kid, loved that kind of thing. So, you know, I can kind of go that way. But it would, you know, to give children a structure that they can use and you know and then from there you know build the story is great. So now if there is you know a teacher or school system administrator listening and they would be interested in having you come to their area, how would they do that?
And there are different ways that this happens. This is often arranged through a local bookstore who will ask me to come in, and they'll handle arranging with a visit to several schools at once, or if they contact me directly, we can figure out how to get me out there. So I can always be found on my Facebook page at facebook.com/JamesRHannibal or through the contact page of www.thelostpropertyoffice.com. That's the title of the first book, thelostpropertyoffice.com, and they can contact me there, and we can figure out a way to get me out there to teach some workshops with the kids.
Oh, great. Well, I know a lot of teachers, so I'm going to be sure to, you know, let them know about that, you know, that opportunity for them to do that, because, you know, this is it's a great way to, you know, first of all, you know, it builds popularity for your series, but it also really just empowers kids to write, you know, and right now, I mean, if it's not 140 characters, then, you know, forget it, you know, and
right,
you really
yes,
need
absolutely.
To foster that.
So get them to engage that abstract thinking and in go beyond the shallow and write something more.
Yeah. Exactly. So now, after the fourth Ruby, was there something in the works for Section 13?
In fact, I just turned it in the day after fourth Ruby came out, which was Halloween. I turned in the tentatively titled The Clockwork Dragon, and that is the third book in the series. And so in the first book, we were very focused on the Ministry of Trackers, and we got to see a little bit of the Ministry of Guilds and the Toppers, as each of the ministries has a sort of a nickname. So we have the Dragos, the Toppers, the Spooks, or the Ministry of Secrets, and then they all sort of look down upon the Ministry of Trackers, and so they call them crumbs. Sic biscuitus disintegratum, that's how the cookie crumbles. And so in the first book, we were looking at the Ministry of Trackers, and we got a good look at the Ministry of Guilds. In the fourth Ruby, we saw the Ministry of Secrets and the Mobius Tower, which is a very confusing tower. You can see that on the cover, where it looks like we're both upside down and right side up. And then in the Clockwork Dragon, we really get a look at the Ministry of Dragons, and we get a little glimpse of the Ministry of Dragons on the fourth Ruby. So there's some fun there. I couldn't wait until Clockwork Dragon to throw some dragons into the story. So we get to play with them there. Yeah, I've been waiting. I waited two books to finally write the Clockwork Dragon, and I was so excited to play with dragons for, you know, basically 9 months as I wrote that book. But one of the fun things about Clockwork Dragon that we can look forward to and that I enjoyed while writing was the pairing up, we're working together between the British Ministry of Dragons and the Chinese Ministry of Dragons. And those are two very different ways of looking at dragons. The Eastern world has a different concept of what a dragon is and what it does versus the Western world. And so marrying those two up in the same story was a significant challenge, but it was also a lot of fun.
Wow, it would be. And, guys, I was trying to think, a couple weeks ago I had someone on a show and they were talking about dragons as well. And it's like, it seems like dragons are making a resurgence you know, in today's world. So.
Oh yes, I think they are.
Yeah, very much. Well, James, I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you, and I'm going to again spread the word about not only about the fourth movie, but also about your work, because I think it's really good work, and I want to thank you for doing that for students. I'm sure that the school systems and teachers and students all appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate that too. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been James R. Hannibal. We've been talking about his new book, The Fourth Ruby. And again, his book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show, and until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.